Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the 467th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta. And with that great intro, we're bringing back Jamie for one more podcast. Jamie, do you want to just say a little bit about yourself, and then we'll leave it up to James to summarize the first two.
Perfect. Yeah, so I'm Jamie Falk. I'm an associate professor at the College of Pharmacy at the University of Manitoba and a practicing pharmacist in Winnipeg in family medicine.
So if you've been following the play sheet for the last two podcasts, we've been talking about sort of the evidence around all the different inhalers. And it's pretty much a gong show as far as the numbers of inhalers and all the different products. And I think we narrowed it down to that there are really... There's sort of the short-acting agents that, you know, you guys can tell me if you disagree with any of my synopsis here. The short-acting agents are very useful for if you have symptoms now. So that's, I mean, and even though the evidence isn't solid for these because they've been around for years, there's actually a couple of interesting withdrawal trials in COPD. When you stop those agents, people don't like it. So we know that those probably have an effect. Then the question gets into what do we do after that? And we talked a little bit about, the inhalers that we have. And really, we have three different types of drugs in them: the long-acting muscarinic agents, the long-acting beta agonists, and we have corticosteroids. And then to maintain patent protection, we put them in different ways of delivering them. And so I think we got through sort of, we talked a fair amount about the dual treatment, so the long-acting agents, long-acting muscarinic agents, plus the LABA. And I think we said when you use one, you get, you know, I don't even want to use the word reasonable, but you get sort of a benefit. What would you say, Jamie? What number would you use? I'm sort of thinking roughly around 30 as a numbers needed to treat.
Yeah, maybe as good as, you know, 15, but probably 15 to 30.
Yeah. And then and this sort of applies to almost any treatment in medicine, and I'm sure you would agree, Mike, is that when you add another agent, you can get a bit more benefit, but you don't get double the benefit. You certainly don't get double the benefit from doubling the dose of a drug. And, you know, you don't always necessarily get double the benefit from adding two drugs.
Yeah, no, that's the case a lot of the time. And just, I don't know if you mentioned it, James, but just as a reminder, I think most people know we're talking about COPD here, not
yes.
Asthma.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Sorry if I didn't. That's why I said if people were paying attention. And by that, I mean the person who's listening right now.
By that, you mean Jamie and I.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I thought because often we drift off.
Yeah, I thought, yeah. You know, all of a sudden, Mike all of a sudden screams gonorrhea. And it's really, it's a bit disconcerting, Mike. You've got to stop doing that. And then we talked about inhaled corticosteroids, and I think the sort of the general gist of that was they have some effect, but the concern in contrast to the other agents is that they also increase the risks for pneumonias and thrush and voice changes and things like that. So, you know, they provide, you know, not a lot of additional benefit, but certainly the possibility of harm from things like pneumonias, thrush, and like I said, voice disturbances. And so, you know, we are a bit reticent to use those. But Jamie, you know as well, and Mike, you know, both of you guys know well, it is a huge amount of these, people with COPD are on these triple, Jamie calls it the triple threat versus the dynamic duo.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of people on them. And just a couple things for this podcast, because we're moving on. Jamie's got a few more things to talk about. But one of them, and we joked about it, but it is serious, is eosinophils. So if you're part of the game for today, will be to guess what time during this podcast we'll bring up eosinophils.
Yeah. And Jamie and Mike will let,
and well, there'll be a ding. Yeah, there'll be a... ding moment. But James, I think from your synopsis, I think the biggest take-home message was, and I wrote it down when you said it, people don't like it when you stop their stuff.
Well, they don't like it when you stop their, they don't like it when you stop they're short acting beta agonists.
No, I know.
The rest of them, I don't think they go up.
I'm just wondering about, does that work for salaries?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, we digress as always, Mike. Thank you. So, Jamie, why don't you take over? Because it's just not going anywhere.
That's a lot of pressure.
I know.
Yeah. So we kind of left off last time on a number of things, but I think the triple therapy idea with a lot of trials out there, numerous systematic reviews, the majority or at least half of the volume of those systematic reviews, and at least in individual systematic reviews, would come from the IMPACT trial. And as we talked about last time, we're talking about a reduction in exacerbations, somewhere around 0.3 exacerbations per patient per year, or if you want to kind of translate that, maybe one saved every 3 years. These were people with that had had multiple, off, at least one, if not multiple exacerbations in the prior year. And a very tiny reduction in hospitalizations. There was actually less than 1%, but a reduction in mortality that was seen. Patients didn't really feel much better. If you look at quality of life, again, we're looking at numbers needed to treat of somewhere around 13 or so to have one person feel possibly that they have a better quality of life, mm-hmm. and really unreliable dyspnea score changes. And then with that was kind of the what we called a bit of a wash with pneumonia occurring in a number needed to harm that was fairly similar to a number needed to treat. And so one of the things that I wanted to talk about was that was the IMPACT trial that was looking at the fluticasone-based triple therapy. And what we saw there, some exceptions to previous trials, was that you could have a history of asthma. You could meet that definition, but you couldn't currently have a diagnosis of asthma to get in, but you could have had a past history of it. And about 70% of people were on inhaled steroids before they got into the study. And about 40% of people were actually on triple therapy, meaning if you're randomized to the dual therapy group, you're actually coming off of therapy. You are de-escalating therapy, which is a weird thing, I think, in these kinds of trials. And the reason I bring that up is because when we look at the Ethos trial, which is remarkably similar. So this is AstraZeneca's version with budesonide compared to the IMPACT trial, which was fluticasone. The trial was set up very similarly. The patients looked quite the same. The reduction in exacerbations was very similar, 0.35 instead of 0.3. There were actually no statistical differences in hospitalizations in this trial, but again, a 1% reduction in mortality for the triple therapy if you use the high dose group, so about a number needed to treat of 100. Again, they didn't really feel better overall. The group didn't meet the minimal clinically important difference for health quality. But if you treat again 13 to 15 of them, you'll have one additional one that will report a better quality of life potentially. They'll meet that minimum at least. So the similarity here, in addition to kind of the findings and the people that were in it, is again, you could have had a distant history of asthma. And in this case, 80% had been on inhaled steroids prior to randomization. And again, about 40% were on triple therapy prior to coming into the study. This trial also showed an increase in pneumonia. Number needed to harm was higher than what we saw in previous meta-analyses. So this was about a number needed to harm of about 59, but it existed as well.
And this trial, this was just recently published, this trial.
Yeah, so this was June in New England Journal of Medicine, so very recent. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to kind of pick on a couple of things from this, because as I mentioned in the last episode, previous COPD trials hadn't really allowed people with asthma into the trials, but these two trials did, and now that we're getting into triple therapy, we have people coming into trials because triple therapy has been around for a while. We have people coming into these trials already on these therapies. So when you look at things like exacerbation rates and mortality, and you try to tease out who was on inhaled steroids before coming into the trial, it's quite interesting. So if you look at the IMPACT trial, and this was just published in June of this year as well, this post hoc analysis, when they looked at people that were on triple therapy, that was where we saw the biggest difference in exacerbation rates between triple therapy and dual therapy was people that started on it, because if you were randomized to the triple therapy, you essentially stayed on what you were on. And if you were on dual therapy, you got taken off of what you had been on potentially for a number of years prior to that. And when you look at the curves in the IMPACT trial, and you look at where those Kaplan-Meier curves separate, if you can imagine that, the separation starts and basically happens all within a month to 6 weeks. And after that, the curves are almost identical, meaning we don't expect that there's any additional benefit after that. It's that first month where there was this rapid surge in exacerbations. And you kind of have to wonder if you could have met a standard definition of asthma, and if you were taken off a therapy that you had been on, you would expect within possibly the first month, as you are now, your body is adjusting to not being on that medication, you would expect maybe that's when you would have your exacerbation. So that was one of the findings that I found interesting.
Yeah, and it's just one of the sort of the confounders, right? It's that's what we always look for in all of these clinical trials, to see if can we trust the results. And I'm not saying we can't trust them, but that's an important nuance. I mean,
yeah, the Kaplan-Meier curves are interesting, and obviously we can't show you those.
But we will post the slides. Yeah.
But one of the things you look for is the pattern of when the two interventions separate, and often it's a very slow thing over time where they separate. Sometimes in some interventions it takes a year or so before they start to separate. But in this case, as Jamie indicates, it's very quick, mm-hmm. and then nothing further happens.
Yeah, nothing further than once you get out past 2 to 3 months.
It's the same all the way through. So yeah, that's it. It's an interesting one, and it does make one wonder, or it appears anyway, that it's all front loaded, and with the kind of missing piece that this is in many ways a withdrawal trial. It just suggests that it's that short term withdrawal effect, and then it stabilizes, and we're all back to normal again. So it does raise an important question about what the real benefit of these drugs are when you start to understand that it could be a withdrawal effect more than anything. And I think it's back to what James said, people don't like it when you stop their stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Keep listening for more science.
Yes.
if you look at that's the kind of exacerbation data. If you look at mortality, because again, we haven't ever really seen mortality differences when you use inhalers, mm-hmm. when you add inhalers onto one another. And again, we have to be careful because these are post hoc analyses of original trials. But I think the important question, if we go down this road of being on an inhaled corticosteroid prior or not, both Ethos and IMPACT now have their mortality breakdowns published in the American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine. One of them actually just a couple of weeks ago, the Ethos breakdown. But what you see in that is that when you look at if you were on an ICS at screening, your point estimate lines up with the trial results overall. For the most part, and when you look at those that were not on ICS at screening, it's actually on the other side of the line, favoring dual therapy, not statistically, but across that line, which is interesting. And if you look at the IMPACT study, it's actually a very similar picture. When you isolate those that were not on inhaled corticosteroids at screening, that's the only group that you see on the other side of the line. Everyone else is on the side favoring triple, which again suggests that if you're not on a steroid starting, you're kind of where we would think one would be starting if they had COPD. Mm-hmm. They're on a couple of inhalers and you're adding one. That's really the picture we're seeing. And if we're looking at that picture, we're actually not seeing that benefit. Again, these are post hoc analyses. We have to be careful with that. But I think that's an interesting finding that has come out of all this.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think it's it just adds almost to the mess, if you will, of the data of trying to figure out what to do. And
yes.
And yes. You know, yes. and you know, because we can never test to see whether we've reduced mortality or even exacerbations, because they're so consistently inconsistent. And the same applies to symptoms. And so it's just important that we need to know as much as possible who did benefit versus who didn't. And if we can find subsets that help us go, this person is more likely or not to benefit, that helps somewhat. Other than that, then one just goes, well, put them on everything and see what happens. And you know, that's the tricky part. But so anything more about the ethos and impact that you want to talk about, Jamie?
No, those are the main things.
Now I know you've got some stuff on, you know, sort of primary care.
Yeah, and I think probably alluded to this directly or indirectly in the last couple of podcasts, but this is going back to some older studies called the UNLOCK studies that were looking at COPD patients in primary care, and this is a comparison to some of the large COPD studies. So this was in PLOS ONE in 2014. So the big trials we're talking about now, the last two wouldn't have been in this, but they would fall within what we're seeing in these results. And when they compared large COPD studies to the UNLOCK studies in primary care populations, people in primary care had overall better FEV1s. They had lower scales of on the gold category, so they had mm-hmm. less severe disease. And they had better quality of life overall. And they used the St. George Respiratory Questionnaire score. And I found it quite interesting. When you look at the details of these scores, you can see in the UNLOCK studies, their score was about 33. And if you recall, we were talking about the systematic reviews, the meta-analyses, where overall they were somewhere around 45. In this comparison, it was around 48. So 48 compared to 33, that's about a 15-point difference. And remember, we were talking about a minimally clinically important difference of 4. It just puts some of this into perspective that we're not dealing with the same patients a lot of the time in primary care. That doesn't mean we don't have severe COPD patients, but overall, when they looked at the proportion of primary care patients that were eligible for inclusion in large RCTs, it ranged from about 17 to 42% of primary care patients would have been eligible for these big trials.
And Mike, I'm sure you'd agree that's an important point, because it tells, because I would say still the vast majority of COPD people are probably dealt with in primary care. And so you need to know, you know, are the people in the studies like the people that you see? And if they're not, you may need to treat them differently.
Yeah, and we hear all the time, right, that we're not getting as many people on drugs, et cetera. And yet, when you look at this result, you realize that our patients are not, in general, as severe and probably don't warrant all these medicines. And who is enrolled in the clinical trials that show barely, you know, pretty borderline benefit at double and triple, and our patients aren't nearly that sick on average. We all can point to some patients in our practice that are really very sick in heart failure, really, really sick in COPD, sick in asthma, and et cetera. But that's not the standard patients we have. I think of my asthma patients, the vast majority of my asthma patients need nothing more than the Ventolin or salbutamol puffer when they're exercising or when they get sick or something like that, and very rarely need augmentation with corticosteroids. Mm-hmm. And so I think, but I can also think of patients who are, you know, absolutely not adequately controlled on regular use of puffers at high doses in the same breath. So I just think that it's important in these cases to remember that our patients are very different, and as everyone listening likely knows, grossly underrepresented in clinical trials, which we're then trying to apply to our patient population. So the UNLOCK studies had 3,500 patients, and the larger COPD studies had 24,000. And that was back in 2014. Now we've got even bigger studies published with sicker patients. So that number would only, that difference would only be much larger and worse. So it is hard sometimes to take this data and extrapolate it to our patients. But we, and Scott Garrison's working on this, doing some of this very work around COPD and how our patients are not nearly as sick, not likely to exacerbate anyway. And if that's our goal, is preventing exacerbations, we just have to be careful about who we select. Yeah.
So we've now pretty much gone, we'll do a little spin at the end, but we've gone over all of the data right now that we have for these inhalers. And so I'm going to put you guys both on the spot and say, you know, you guys see people on a week, day, maybe weekly basis anyway, that you have to make these decisions. And so we talked about this a little bit before. There are two ways to think about this. It's do you think of them as a statin? And I'm going to put it in that context where you're trying to, you know, reduce the risk of future events and you'll never know if you get that. Or do you do it symptom based? So if they're symptomatic and you give them an inhaler and they don't get any better, do you then stop it? Or if they do get better, you go, wow, that's great. So I, you know, what are you guys now doing in your practice? Jamie, why don't you start? Because, you know, you know more about this data than either Mike or I.
Yeah, I think probably I've done both. And to be honest with you, probably for most of my career, I've been a symptom based person, knowing that the preventative approach, meaning reduction in exacerbations, is so small. I've attempted to approach it from a symptom based manner, but over the last year or so, and James, you and I have had these discussions. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to justify that symptom-based approach anymore. And I continue to think that there are probably, there are going to be a number of patients that are going to just do alarmingly well for some reason. But I think those are, that's a really small proportion of the people we treat. And the rest of them, I'm just not sure we're going to be able to tell if they're feeling better day to day.
Yeah, and you might be able to tell whether they're feeling better, but you can't really tease out whether it's the drug that's doing it.
Right,
you know, and
not with great certainty.
Yeah,
but,
well,
you know, if you had somebody who was very symptomatic and they've been that way for a long time, they start a puffer, and 4 weeks later they come back and say, "I feel quite a bit better." Yeah. That's that rare guy that Jamie's talking about, and you can say, "Well, if we stop it, we'll know for sure." But a lot of the time, you don't, because you think, "Well, the odds are," and I like the fact that I can feel that I've helped make you better. Mm-hmm. So you kind of keep them on it. But it's most of the time, you're right though, right? The biggest answer you get when you ask, do you think this is helping you, is I'm not sure.
Yeah.
That's the most common, or some variation on that theme. That's where it gets so tricky. And you can try questions like, do you think you can walk further? And if their spouse is there, do you think your spouse can walk further? You know, are you able to do more around the house? Here's some of the things. What weren't you doing 2 months ago? Like vacuum cleaning or cutting the lawn or shoveling or stuff, you know. But it's very, very tricky. The way I do it is I go for symptoms if that's what the person's complaint is. But if they're coming in because they've just been in hospital with an exacerbation again, then I'm often targeting that outcome. I know it's not perfect because the presence of an exacerbation doesn't necessarily predict another one, as you've indicated previously, James. But certainly, if there's a couple, that person would be more likely, and that might be a fire and forget kind of scenario.
Yeah.
With a hope that you're also going to get symptoms, but who knows?
Yeah, and I think one of the things we should also be saying is, you know what? I have no problem if you stop and start these on occasion and let me know, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. you know they do it anyway. You know, there's a small percentage of people who are very, you know, they take it exactly within minutes of what they're supposed to take it, but they, you know, not a lot of people don't do that. So, I mean, I think we need to give them the comfort of saying, I know that you're probably not taking it regularly all the time. I mean, but if you are, great. But if you're not, maybe you could let me know. if you think, because if you don't use it for a few days or a week and you don't notice any difference, then we both need to know that.
Right.
You know, so I think we should give that. And that's what I always tell people who I'm talking to about their medications. I don't care if you take it or not. I care to know if you take it. That's what I really want to know, because then we can really make useful decisions. But I agree with both of you guys. And there's lots of articles on this. Some people say, you know, you just use it as like you said, the fire and forget. And others said, you do it based on symptoms. Neither is right. I mean, but neither is wrong. I mean, it's, there's so, you know, the only real answer is don't smoke.
Yeah, for goodness sake.
And I realize that not everybody who has COPD was a smoker, but that's the tricky part. Now, is there anything else you want to add to that? Because what we're going to want to do is just put a little bit of a spin on it that might give us a little bit more useful information.
I think we do need to address the because this is very – the next piece, and get ready for, you know, winning the game, is the next piece is talked a lot about by our respirology colleagues. And James, not me. I would never make fun of my colleagues who might – rely heavily on mechanism of action or
no, because you have much more tact than I do. But what's the word you're looking for, Mike? What are you going to talk about next?
I don't know. You guess, James.
I think Jamie wants to say the word, because otherwise, you know,
who's going to do the ding?
Yeah,
I will. That's always my role.
Here we go.
Eosinophils.
There we go.
Ding ding ding.
so let's talk about that a little bit, because there's some interesting science, and it's not so much mechanism of action. There is a mechanism behind the thought, but there's a little bit of evidence.
This harkens back to when we had Tim Caulfield on, and the idea of kind of individualizing interventions more specifically to patients who will benefit from them.
Yeah.
It would be lovely if I knew ahead of time you will never benefit from a statin, but you likely or will absolutely benefit from a statin. Like, if we could imagine a world where we could do that. Now, that we've talked a lot before. In most cases, that's a pipe dream. But this
it's not a pipe dream. We can pretty much guarantee you're not going to get a benefit. No, but I mean, you've had 12 heart attacks and you get put on a statin, you still only,
lifetime, give them a lifetime.
Yeah. Even a lifetime, at least 70% are not going to get any benefit if the benefit is real. So that's why it gets tricky, rather than Mike and I going on, why don't you tell us a little bit about eosinophils then, Jamie?
Sure. Yeah. So I mean, mechanistically, the reason why we would even think about this is when we look at eosinophilia from an airway standpoint, it's kind of a hallmark response in asthma, and it's believed or it is involved in inflammatory processes in COPD. But that could mean many different things. One of the questions is, do blood eosinophils correlate to sputum eosinophilia? Knowing that we're not going to be checking people's sputum necessarily, but could we do a simple blood test like blood eosinophils, and would that give us an understanding of whether an anti-inflammatory agent like a corticosteroid would help a patient with COPD? And so you can fairly easily draw a curve looking at inhaled corticosteroid response in clinical trials. If you break people up into their eosinophil counts, but of course people in these trials wouldn't have been randomized necessarily based on eosinophil counts, and that wasn't the goal of these trials, but you can fairly quickly see that response rates in these trials goes up as eosinophil counts go up.
And what I was going to say, and so these are all post hoc looks, because you measure a bazillion things in these tests, in these studies, and this is, and they thought maybe that there's an association with this, and that's they certainly did find that.
Yeah, and we talked about, you know, one of the problems with the corticosteroids is their risk of pneumonia, and it's pretty much a wash, as Jamie, and then Jamie also indicated that there is a reasonable question, is is the benefit seen in these triple therapy studies versus dual therapy? Is that just because we're withdrawing them that they're having exacerbations or just being symptomatically worse? So if we had a way to identify the patients who were more likely to benefit so that the ratio of benefit to harms, primarily pneumonia, but other things, was increased, that would be lovely. Yeah. So there is some data on that, Jamie, I think.
Yeah. And so again, we're looking at numerous trials that would have been in the systematic reviews we talked about earlier, would have looked at eosinophils, again, as in addition to a whole host of other things. But in some cases, it was predefined up front that they wanted to take a look at this particularly based on the theory of this. And so when you look at some of the trials, we can see different kind of set points. Is it eosinophils greater than 150? Is it greater than 300 or greater than 400? Generally, if you look at kind of a plot, it seems to look like the larger the eosinophils, the potential greater relative risk reduction you get by using an inhaled corticosteroid. And pulling from a couple of trials, some authors were able to look at numbers needed to treat in those when you're looking at triple versus dual therapy and looking at about 12 months, looking at the number needed to treat if you had an eosinophil count that was less than 300 or greater than 300 and compare that to the overall number needed to treat. And if you remember back to the last episode, it was a number needed to treat of about somewhere around 39 to prevent a moderate or severe exacerbation, most of those being moderate exacerbations. If you look at the participants who had eosinophil counts of at least 300, that number needed to treat dropped to 9, which is a pretty remarkable drop. It's huge, right? So you look at that and it's alarming, and you think if this is true, it's fairly remarkable, and it could potentially be important.
Mm-hmm, because you're talking about moving from a 2.5% absolute benefit to around an 11% absolute mm-hmm. benefit.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
And then the other, because that pooled overall NNT includes those with a low eosinophil count, if you look at that subgroup as well, its NNT actually goes up, meaning that it has only a 2% absolute benefit. So there is potential reason here to differentiate based on these patients, because if they have low eosinophils and you were waffling about whether to start a corticosteroid puffer, that should reassure you that no, you don't really need to.
And I think you can make a legitimate argument that, you know, a 2.5% benefit versus a 10% benefit is probably something that you go, that's
important.
Yeah, it could be important.
I do want to bring up something very important. This is because this isn't randomized data anymore. There's some limits, and we're looking at, dare I say it, Bradford Hill criteria. Mm-hmm. So, James, can you take us through all the criteria? I know you have them memorized.
Yes.
Off the top of your head.
Yes.
So the rules of causation.
The rules of causation, and there's a whole bunch of them, and even the guy who developed them didn't really develop them for that purpose, but that's another story.
And he didn't believe them.
No. But you know, so.
No, but there are things in there like a, you know, the kind of dose response of all of these kind of things.
And that timing you're seeing and all here, sorts of right? things. Yeah.
Like timing, and then the linkages to the eosinophils and asthma. So maybe these patients have an asthma-like component. All mm-hmm. of those. There's a few criteria that this is meeting. It doesn't meet all of them, but it is. There is some logic behind this that's not faulty, but it could also just be a distractor. It would be lovely to have a true RCT based on this.
Yeah, but yeah, because you guys know as well as I do, when you do these post hoc analyses and then you go actually study them, more often than not, they don't come out.
Yeah, that's the problem. Even though this looks good, and
absolutely,
you know, as Jamie said, the higher the eosinophils, the more the benefit. Like, there's all these things that meet the rules of causation kind of criteria for making it believable. But we've been down this road so many times that, okay, now it's so believable we have to do an RCT, and it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So what's, I mean, what would you guys do with this information?
Yeah. Yeah. Jamie, you want to go first? I can go first. It doesn't really matter. It's going to be wrong.
It doesn't matter. I was thinking about this earlier today and you can take the approach of saying we need a clinical trial to actually address this question, and until we can do that and try to balance out other modifiers in that trial, like prior asthma, what was their exacerbation history, balance all of those things out, and then ask the question of eosinophils as the primary question. That would be the most pure way to go. But to be honest with you, I don't think it's an unreasonable thing to think if you've got a patient on a LABA LAMA, they continue to be symptomatic, they have a recent history, meaning, you know, some not obviously right now an exacerbation, but sometime in that fairly consistently year to year they have exacerbations. Is it unreasonable to say if they meet all those criteria, let's do an eosinophil count, and if it's high, and again we don't know what high is, but let's say it's 300. If it comes back as greater than 300, is it unreasonable to say let's have that conversation now. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what that estimated benefit is. In the trials that subgrouped based on eosinophils, they, like the other trials, they actually didn't find any difference in dyspneas and quality of life, at least not any more than the other trials did, whether you were high or low. So day to day, you probably won't feel better regardless. There's still that pneumonia risk that's likely just same.
Yeah.
And then there's the cost issue. And so I don't think it's unreasonable to take that approach, but I feel a little dirty sometimes saying that.
No, but you know, the good thing, so, cause what we're trying to do is make it, you know, figure out if there's a difference between whether or not to start a triple versus a dual. And there's a big cost difference.
It's huge.
You know, so, yeah. You know, I can almost guarantee you, you know, getting an eosinophil count is going to be less than the difference between 1 month's treatment.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to be way
the
less.
The only time I've used this information recently was, and really the information to me is relatively recent. So the time I've used it is I happened to be refilling a guy looking for other things. I was actually, was other drugs, and I was looking for his creatinine level, and I noticed his CBC indicated abnormal, and then I peeked at it, and it was an eosinophil. They were high. They weren't dangerously high, but they were just at the higher, just above normal. And I thought, oh, well, maybe he's a guy that actually might benefit from a corticosteroid inhaler, like that being added.
Yeah.
In a cascade of other, you know, it's the classic kind of older person with multiple conditions. So you're weighing a bunch of drugs, but one of his concerns was. Breathlessness.
Yeah. And if you knew that, you just know that instead of 2.5% of people benefiting, it goes to 10.
Yeah. And, you know, and that actually is, you know, before when they were tied, I generally don't ever, you know, I'm trying to remember this guy, but it was either he was on it and I was started my speeches about stopping drugs and then saw it, or reverse. I can't honestly remember, but what I remember most is looking at his eosinophils and that actually adding a couple percent to my final recommendation to him.
Yeah, no. Yeah. I think it's useful to do that. I mean, it's not like this is a terribly expensive test, and you do it one time.
Well, they have, like, the chances that your patient doesn't have a CBC with diff on it.
Exactly.
I would say most of the time you wouldn't need to test it because it's
already done.
Been there, especially because there are older, frailer people and with multiple, you know, COPD. Sometimes it's alone, but most of the time it's traveling with other conditions, and these tests would have been done. So
it's worth, I think it's worth taking a peek. And it might, you know, might push you a little bit more to encourage them to try it with all of the caveats that we've just talked about. So, anything else, guys? Because, I mean, this is, Jamie, great job of presenting all this information. It's a lot of data. It's boy, you got to spend a lot of time looking at it to try and figure it out. It's not nearly what it says in the adverts.
Absolutely. And if you want to know how much it takes, Jamie hasn't seen his children in 2.5 months.
No,
that's right.
To get into the data to this level, yeah.
Yeah, they've forgotten my name.
Yeah. Yeah, they. Well, you kept calling them Ventolin. And
that's right. Little Ventolin and big Ventolin, yeah.
So, so anything else, Mike, you want to add, or are you done?
No, I think, honestly, it was an amazingly great job, and sorry that we goofed around probably too much, Jamie, yeah. But you did cover a lot of great material.
Yeah. So anything else you want to add, Jamie? If not?
No, that was was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And I think when I think of just this, even this last question that we were talking about, I try to think of what harms these decisions we would make would come to our patient. And so I think as long as we're keeping that in mind and being straightforward and upfront with our patients about what we know and what we don't know about these things, I think we can make informed decisions that we can feel confident are in the best interest of the patient, right?
Yeah, totally. No, totally agree. Great stuff. So I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.